So here's how I want to start this morning. I want you to turn to your neighbor, and I want you to do this. Not yet. I'll tell you when to go. I want you to turn to somebody around you and describe Jesus. Like what you think Jesus was like. Like, and I'm not going to ding you. I'm not going to punish you for having the wrong answer. There's really no right answer to this question. But when you think in your imagination about Jesus, what was he like? Go. What are some of the best ones? Don't tell me what you think. Tell me what you heard somebody else say that amused you. Or go ahead and say what you want. Yeah, surrounded by people that ask stupid questions. All right. What? He was a hippie. Paradoxical. Hippie carpenter. People person. Relatable, rebellious peacemaker, peace and humble, gentle, firm. I like all these oxymorons we're putting together. Yes, what else? Introverted, not good looking. The one in the bottom right is hot, right? Like, that is one good looking Jesus. I love lightsaber Jesus. I don't know why. I don't know why. I just did a search for Jesus and then found the craziest ones I could find. And muscle Jesus. Scott McKnight, in his book Blue Parakeet a couple years ago, many of you have read this book, talks about when he's a professor at, was it North Park? I can't remember where he's at now. But he talks about giving his freshmen a quiz just like the one I just gave you. What was Jesus like? And asked a bunch of questions. When it was done, then he gave the students a personality quiz and asked them to describe themselves. And you know what they discovered? What's that? We all make Jesus in our own image. That I tend to think that Jesus was a guy who loved a good laugh, was kind of a foodie, and talked loud and fast and loved being around people, right? Like that's, of course Jesus was like that, because I'm like that, and I like me. And so we all tend to do this to Jesus. We all tend to project upon Jesus what we want Jesus to be. We do it in a lot of other places in life too. We project what we feel, what we think on other people and just assume. That's why the best friends that give advice are not the ones that say, that just assume that, oh, this is how I would feel if I was in that situation. But the best people are the ones that can distance themselves and help you understand you and not help you understand me. I just butchered all those pronouns. But so we all do that to Jesus. And I think, for me, part of the spiritual journey, a big part of the spiritual journey, is me being open to this idea that Jesus probably isn't just like Charlie. Probably. Maybe. Right? And being open to exploring who Jesus is and being challenged in my assumptions. So, like probably most of us, just instinctively when we think of Jesus, what color is his skin? White. We just think that because it's been in our churches and hangs on our walls. There's things that just come to mind. And so the challenge, I remember the first time when I was like probably in my early 20s, late teens, that somebody's like, Jesus wasn't white. And I was like, of course. Oh, of course Jesus wasn't white. That makes no sense at all. In fact, the one up in the upper left was, that came from like a year or so ago. I can't remember what organization. Maybe the BBC did a documentary and they were trying to get to what would the most historical representation of Jesus look like. And that was the picture they came up with, the one in the upper left. Not to be confused with the one from Dogma right next to it. So part of the spiritual journey, to me a big part of the spiritual journey, is always this openness to re-examining Jesus. Back in February, I went to the prayer breakfast, and one of the things that happened at the prayer breakfast for me, the National Prayer Breakfast, everybody has their own ideas about what that is, and probably depending on who you go with, your perspective is skewed that way. And I was meeting with a friend Friday who's like, that just feels like a bunch of politicians pretending like they like Jesus for 10 minutes. And I was like, well, I'm sure it is that for some people, but that wasn't my experience of it. And in my experience of it, we got to spend some time with some pretty amazing people. And one of my highlights, one of the probably the thing I've thought about the most over the last 4 weeks since I was at the prayer breakfast was the group I was with, we got to spend time with this pastor. His name is Steve. He was a vineyard pastor in Washington State or Oregon, whatever, up there somewhere. And he was a pastor, a vineyard pastor. Crazy story of how he became a pastor, got slain in the spirit, and he didn't even believe in that kind of thing, and then found himself on the floor and was like, I don't know what just happened, but something happened. And so he became a pastor. But in time, he talks about how he had a transformation in his thinking about Jesus, which led him right out of the pastorate. And so now, I'm still not sure how all this works, but he travels to the world, like, telling people about Jesus. And I was like, so you're a missionary? He's like, no, I don't try to convert anybody. Like, the Bible doesn't tell me to convert anybody. It just tells me to tell people about Jesus. And I'm like, okay. So then how do you eat? You know, like, all these practical, like, questions. He's like, I just talk about Jesus. So here's what I want to tell you all about this. So for an hour and a half, I sat in the room with this man who was telling us the things that he loves about Jesus and how he thinks about Jesus. And I don't know what a Sunday morning feels like to you. Sometimes for me, it feels like the sermon goes by like this. And other times, even for me, it feels like, get over on with it, buddy. Like, let's get to the ending because I'm bored with me. And I'm sure it's that way for you sometimes. But do you ever have those moments where, like, you're so deeply into a conversation and so leaning in that you look at your watch and you're like, an hour and a half just went by? And all we've been doing is talking about Jesus for the last hour and a half. For me, that was my takeaway from the prayer breakfast. It's just this idea. And I was trying to write it the other day, and just for my own benefit, it turned out it was going to be a really dorky blog post. But I started off this thing with, like, just like, I really, this is going to sound so dorky to say, but I'll say it anyway. I really, really like Jesus. Like, really, really. Like, I was talking to somebody recently. I'm like, if I had to go to seminary again and do all the theology stuff, I don't care about talking about theology. But I want to talk about Jesus whenever I can, as much as I can. And a month after prayer breakfast, all these things are still in my head that I just want to talk more about Jesus and follow Jesus. Because I think that's as simple as the faith gets, right? Like, we know we're Christians. That's what makes us Christians. We're following Jesus, right? And then they'll know that we are Christians by our love. Because that's what Jesus said to us. So this Sunday is the one Sunday in Lent I get to teach. Because, you know, like, we've had a series going over the last couple weeks, if you missed it. And so we got done with that last week. And then next week, Claire is here. And then the week after that, we have another really cool thing happening. So this was my one Sunday to teach, and I was like, well, I want to talk about Jesus, and I really wanted to talk about some of these ideas that have been in my head over the last couple months about Jesus. So I told you last week I was going to do a talk this morning called Signature Moves of Jesus, right? So you know the signature. I was watching yesterday online. I was trying to look for a good clip and then video stuff, and it was a pain. But it was like how to shoot the Michael Jordan signature move, the fadeaway jumper, right? So how, like, that is, if you think of Michael Jordan in your head, you think fadeaway jumper, right? Like, that's one of the things you think. You also think of Chad Elo? The dude that he, like, was it Craig Elo. Yes, I love that dude. Oh, you're from Cleveland. Yes, that makes it better. All right, sorry for those of you that were, never mind. And so I started this week, and I was like, what's the passage I want to talk about this week? And then it ended up that it was five different passages I wanted to teach about, and I realized I had like a three-hour sermon on my hands. So then I scaled it back to three, and I was like, oh, that's still an hour of talking nonstop. So I scaled it back to one, all right? So turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 22. I want to work through, since it's Lent, and since I want to talk about Jesus, we're going to talk about the Last Supper this morning. I hope it gives you maybe some things to think about and chew on as we move towards Easter. Claire is also aware that it's Lent. It's not a secret. And so she's going to talk about Jesus next week as we get to Lent. And I'm sure when Rob comes, we'll ask him to kind of weave Jesus into something too. And so that's going to kind of be our mini Easter theme leading us up, or mini Lenten theme leading us up to Easter. So I'm going to read, as is our custom, and then I'll ask you all what you think, and then we'll point at a couple things, and then let's read. Luke chapter 22, let's start in verse 7. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, go and make preparation for us to eat the Passover. Where do you want to prepare it? They asked. He replied, as you enter the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him to the house that he enters and say to the owner of the house, The teacher asks, where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, all furnished. Make preparations there. They left and found things just as Jesus had told them, so they prepared the Passover. When the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God. After taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among you. For I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. But the hand of him who is going to betray me is with mine on the table. The Son of Man will go as it has been decreed, but woe to that man who betrays him. They began to question among themselves which of them it might be who would do this, and a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest, as one does. Jesus said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors, but you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on you, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, to strengthen your brothers. But he replied, Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. And Jesus answered, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me. Then Jesus asked them, when I sent you without a purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. But he said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. This is the first mention of a merce in the Bible. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and I will tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. That's enough, he replied. Passage over. I think that's funny, by the way, Dad. Here's two swords. Okay, let's go. Thoughts, comments, observations. What stands out to you in this passage of the Last Supper? Danny.
He says Simon, Simon first when he's, saying, I'm praying for you, but then he's here.
And? Just an observation.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, fine.
I don't know why he does that.
Yeah, I don't know either. Yeah. Jesus knows Peter is going to fall away. It's pretty clear in the text. I'll come back, circle back to that more later. Good. Eric. No, what's significant about that is Judas is included in the fellowship, in the table fellowship. Knowing full well what Judas is about to do, Jesus includes him anyway. Wow. That's, to me, a really beautiful picture. Significant. He doesn't clean up the room first, but rather invites the betrayer to the table. Good. Just.
He set himself up here. He's telling them that they have weapons. They're not going to use them.
Right.
Yeah,
because later he's going to tell them to put away their swords. Yeah,
yeah,
good. A couple more. The way Matthew tells this story is it's almost magical. Like, there's going to be a room, it's going to be fully furnished, and they're like, oh, there it is. Yeah, and Jesus is doing that throughout this passage, showing some... So we often wrestle between the humanity of Jesus and the divinity, and these are these moments where, like, he knows things that he shouldn't be able to know. Yeah.
He's at the table to serve.
Yeah. Good. Steve. Yeah, so let me start there. To me, that's one of the first things in this passage that just grips me. I'm a person that I have to be careful sometimes about my own expectations of events because I blow them all up in my head. Anybody with me? Like, you're one of these? Okay, there's like two of us. All right, so nobody will admit it. Like, and I love the humanity of Jesus, and I picture this. Okay, so here's the setup, right? So the idea of I'm eagerly anticipating this moment with you, and what is that moment specifically? What's he doing with them that he's eagerly anticipating? He's setting this whole thing up, right? So he's saying to them, like, I've eagerly anticipated this moment where I'm going to change every time you eat bread and drink wine. I'm going to change the way you think about it. I was trying to think this week. I think that this is probably the most memorialized act in all of history, right? Today, thousands and thousands and thousands of churches will remember that moment when Jesus did this. And that happens week after week after week across 2,000 years of history. I don't know of any event in history that gets thought about, memorialized more than that very moment right there. It's the biggest, one of the biggest moments in human history, right? And Jesus says, I'm eagerly anticipating this moment with you all. And then it devolves into what? Yeah, are you greater or am I? And not the insinuation of the passage is not me saying, Dave, you're clearly better than me. It's the opposite, right? Like, here's why I deserve to be disciple number one. And I'm going to name my number two and number three. Like, right? Like, this is, and we don't understand exactly why this, like, that seems strange to us anywhere, right? Like, there's no place, I think, that we would, like, let's have a conversation among our friends in the room about who among us is the greatest. But I just, to me, imagine the disappointment of Jesus, right? That here's this moment that's so, and they don't realize what's coming, but there's just this, ugh. But what grips me in this little section is this idea that Jesus is inviting them into a moment that for them seems so very ordinary, right? To break bread and to drink wine, that's like everyday kind of stuff. And they don't understand in the moment that what Jesus is inviting them is a total redefinition of this in their lives. And it makes me wonder sometimes, where is Jesus inviting me into a moment? And I don't see it. Or I don't recognize it. Because it seems so just ordinary. It's just bread and it's just wine. For me, as I've been reflecting on this passage, the first invitation out of the passage to me is to pay attention to the moment. That maybe this week, maybe in the weeks leading up to Lent, that there are moments in our lives where Jesus is waiting to meet us, that he's eagerly anticipating this moment. And the spiritual journey is one of opening our eyes and paying attention and seeing those moments and embracing those moments, even if they feel really small, to embrace that, to hang on to that, to meet Jesus in that moment. But our temptation all the time is that we trip over our own selves, that I get to those moments and I'm worried about my greatness and my thing and all that thing. And so just maybe confession. Lent snuck up on me this year, and I was out of town on Ash Wednesday, and I missed Ash Wednesday, and somebody asked me, like, what are you doing for Lent? And I'm embarrassing, like, nothing. I missed it. I failed Lent this year. Maybe, for those of you like me that flunked Lent this year, maybe the invitation is over the next 3 weeks as we get closer to Easter. Maybe in this season, there's something for you. Maybe God is asking you to draw close to somebody. Maybe God is inviting you into a certain way of living. Maybe God is asking you to forgive someone of something that you've always struggled with. Or maybe it's something that's really small. Whatever that thing is, I think we can say, Jesus is eagerly anticipating meeting you there. So then he goes on, after they break out into who's the greatest, by the way, O'Doyle rules. After they do that, then he gets into this really, he starts talking about leadership and this whole section about the kings of the Gentiles lorded over them. And he starts talking about the table custom thing, which I love as an example, right? So if you go to a good restaurant, who's the greatest person in the restaurant? The person that's paying the bill, right? And the dish staff. You know, and then there's a ranking in the restaurant of cooks and waiters and then busboy. And Jesus is like, who's the greatest person in the restaurant? And everybody says, well, the people that have the money to afford the food. And Jesus is like, yeah, but that's not who I am. I'm the busboy. I'm the waiter. That's who I identify with. And that teaching gets so, like, that's hard for us, right? Because everything in us is attracted. We want to be the ones sitting at the table, right? Like, I would be like, it would be hard for me to like bust tables at 42 years old, like go bust tables for people and feel like, oh, they're greater than me. Like there's that feeling all the time. And Jesus says, but you have to understand that when I come into the room, I don't identify with the people that are buying and purchasing and having the great time. I identify with the people who are serving. And if you're going to follow me and lead in my kingdom, that's where you live, is in that place. Can we all say ouch together? Ouch, right? Even when, like, to be fair, you get around pastors and churches and it's the same stuff, right? Deference given and all that person and that person. And that there's this thing that Jesus is saying about the simplicity of, oh, be a servant. That was any one of my points. I just had to get that in. And then to me, the most interesting exchange is the one Peggy was pointing at here is this. Simon, Simon, verse 31. Simon, oh, and then Jesus gets really enigmatic about judging the 12 tribes of Israel. I have no idea what that's about. Verse 31, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat. So the insinuation here seems to be something that Jesus is aware that all of them are going to face temptation over the next 72 hours or so, right? Jesus is aware that all of them are going to face temptation and then turns it specifically to Peter. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. And then we love Peter, right? Because Peter says what we would all want to say right there. Oh, no way. Lord, I'm ready to go with you to prison and to death. And then Jesus says, I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny me. You will. You will deny me three times that you know me. Here's the thing. Here's the thing that's been stuck in my head for a while. I grew up all the time, and this is part of my own psychosis. I grew up with this idea that God is perpetually disappointed in me. Anybody else? Like, that's the way I tend to always think of God, is that God looks at me most of the time and says, ugh, really? You failed again? You sinned again? You denied me three times when I forecasted it to you. I told you you were going to do it. And then you went out and did the very thing. Like, how dumb does Peter have to be, right? Like, you'd think after the first time, he'd be like, oh, wait a minute. Second time, uh-oh, it's a pattern happening. And then, like, he does it again, right? And yet, I do the exact same things. I sin in the exact same ways that I've done 1,000 times before and I've repented of. And I wonder if this is the signature move of Jesus. This is what the thought is in my head. Is that the sin isn't the thing that matters so much to Jesus. Now, hear me out. I used to think that Jesus was always perpetually somewhat disappointed in me. But it seems like in the passage, the prayer for Peter is not that he won't sin. Jesus doesn't seem concerned with whether or not he sins at the end. What's Jesus' concern with Peter? Is that when you come back, the line here, I love this line, Simon, that your faith may not fail. My interpretation of this, that Simon, your faith won't be determined and defined by your failure. That your relationship with me isn't going to be defined by the fact that you went out and sinned, because you know what we do as human beings? We sin. All of us. I'm going to play Jesus for just a minute. You all are going to sin this week, right? Maybe before we leave the room. Surely before you get home, right? We all will have a thought or do something or whatever. We will sin. And that's just a fact of that. That's life. That's what it is. And Jesus doesn't say to Peter, 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 Satan has asked to sift you like wheat, and I've prayed that you'll resist the temptation and not sin. No, Jesus says, no, you're going to. But it's not going to define the relationship that I have with you. And to me, the beautiful evidence, how do we know that this prayer actually worked? Where do we see this prayer work? At the seashore, when Peter sees Jesus, what is his response? Now, I'll tell you what my response would have been. All right, let me just talk about my own psychosis. If I was Peter, and I'm in that boat, and I would have seen Jesus on the shore, I would have gotten myself real busy on the boat, below decks, right? I would have found all the reasons in the world not to come close to Jesus, because I'm just telling you, shame would have been bound, like my shame levels would have been off the charts, spiraling, all the bad stuff I tell myself all the time. That's what would have happened in me. But what does Peter do when he sees Jesus on the seashore? He jumps off the boat and unceremoniously chugs his way to shore so that he can be with Jesus. I think that's the moment in which Jesus' prayer is answered, that your faith will not fail. Peter denies Jesus 3 times, but it doesn't define his faith because he goes running to Jesus. So often I think that I hear people, I know that I hear people say things like, you know, or I'll just say what I think about myself. I think I've sinned and I've gotten far away from Jesus. And I don't think that's actually true. I think Jesus is always with me. I'm the one that's turned my back. It's like this. I think this idea is that we think Jesus is like an immovable object, like Jesus is the music stand. And we think that when we sin, we're doing this away from God. And I think actually what's happening is when we sin, it's actually kind of like this, right? That Jesus is right there with us, and all we have to do is like, that's weird. That won't show up on the podcast. That's great, because that was weird. But that, to me, here's why I really, really like Jesus, is thinking that way about Jesus is messing with my head a little bit. It's getting at my shame. It's getting at that thing where I always think that I'm screwing this relationship up. And get into this, coming slowly to this understanding that maybe I'm not screwing it up. Now sin is bad. You can quote me on that. Sin is bad. Because sin destroys me. And sin destroys my relationships. And sin causes all kinds of problems for me out here. And I think I should avoid sin because it makes my life worse. But Jesus loves me. And every sin that I ever commit, when we get to Good Friday, every sin I ever commit, it's paid for. It's done. It's there. There's no issue. So the definition of my faith isn't about how I act in relationship to Jesus, but rather the definition of my faith is in Jesus' grace and mercy and love towards me, and that he keeps following me around even if I deny him 3 times. Which on the ranking order of sins, you'd think goes pretty high, right? The, like, I don't know who the man is, swear, right? Like, that should go pretty high on the list of sins. It doesn't define you. And then, in another signature move of Jesus, what does he say after that? That your faith may not fail, and that you will use this to strengthen the brothers. How does Peter strengthen the brothers? With his knowledge? With his moral authority? No. With what? Failure. Failure is the way that Peter's supposed to lead into his community. Failure is the thing that brings him closer to the brothers. Failure is supposed to be... Flip the slide. Henry Nouwen has a book called The Wounded Healer. He says, no one can help anyone without becoming involved, without entering with his whole person into the painful situation, without taking the risk of becoming hurt, wounded, or even destroyed in the process. The beginning and end of all Christian leadership is to give your life for others. Who can take away suffering without entering it? That it's your failure that will help you enter into the suffering of others. He's talking specifically about pastors, but I think it's true for all of us. Since it is the minister's task to make visible the first messages of liberation for others, he must bind his own wounds carefully in anticipation of the moment when he will be needed. He is called to be the wounded healer, the one who must look after his own wounds, but at the same time be prepared to heal the wounds of others. That we don't actually get to help people until we come to them in this place of woundedness, and it's our failures and our deficiencies are the things that strengthen the body. It's saying to the person struggling, me too, me too. That's what strengthens and encourages the body. So 2 invitations. The first one is out of the passage, and it says to let go of our sin as the thing that keeps us from God. That's what Lent is supposed to be about. Lent is not supposed to be about the season where I feel most guilty and I beat myself up and convince myself of how worthless I am. That is, there is a particular way of thinking through theology that does that, right? That I'm worthless, I'm worthless, I'm worthless. God hates me, and lucky he sees Jesus because God's really disappointed. I'm suggesting that's not, for me and my understanding of Jesus these days, that's not the thing for me. And so I think part of this journey is not letting my sin define my relationship, and I need to let go of the idea that my sin is eternally disappointing God. And I want to embrace this attitude of Peter that jumps out of the boat and runs to Jesus even when I feel like I've screwed it all up. And so maybe that's the Lenten invitation for you over the last couple weeks as we end Lent and move towards Easter, is to to let go of your sin and recognize that Jesus already knew you were going to do the thing that you did, and it doesn't matter to him. It matters to you. It's going to mess up your life. But Jesus is with you and wants you to jump off the boat and run to him. The second one is more of a meta invitation. I had five other sermons I wanted to give this morning about things I'm thinking about Jesus and little stories and things that are just in my head about Jesus. And I was having breakfast with a couple friends the other day, and I was telling them, like, I wanna find places to talk about Jesus more. I just do. Like, I like Sunday mornings, and it's good, but it's not enough. I want to talk about Jesus more. And so I want to put an invitation out to you all. This is just an invitation, and here's what I think. I'm not putting it in the notes. It's not on the website. If this matters to you, I think the Spirit will move, and you'll remember, and you'll send me an email this week. All right? That's my working premise right now. And that is, I'm wondering if there might be a group of us that for Holy Week, at least to start, that during Holy Week, you might consider gathering Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of Holy Week, 4 days. If it's in the mornings, maybe even Good Friday, that you would consider gathering with a group of people where we will simply read Jesus, read something out of the Gospels, and ask each other, like, what do we see about Jesus, and how do we move closer to Jesus? And my big thought about this is that I hope it's not just our church people. I don't even know that it has to be just Christian people, that anybody that wants to talk about Jesus, I want to talk with them about Jesus. And so I just want to put it out there, and it might just be me gathering by myself wherever I am and thinking about Jesus, but it would be really cool if there's any of you that would say, you know what, for Holy Week this year, I would give it a really intense small group experience. Like, we're going to see each other every day for the next 5 days, but maybe for some of you, maybe that ignites something in you, and there's an interest there and a desire to. And I don't know any details yet. I think it'd probably be in the evenings after kids are in bed kind of thing. I think. If you're interested, I'm just planting a seed. If you're interested, please email me or talk to me. Let's pray. Jesus, we project so much on you, and much of my life I've spent projecting anger on you and wrath and disappointment. And I think that it doesn't make you disappointed in me, but it makes you sad that I've often kept you at a distance because I've thought I've wronged you. And I admit that I tend to run away from you when I feel like I've screwed things up. I do that in a lot of places in my life. And I want you to change that in me. I want to believe that you love me as much as I think you do. That there's nothing that can separate me from your love. Neither height nor depth nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come. That there's nothing that can separate me from you. And Jesus, the next time I fail, the next time I sin, or the next time any of us sin, I pray that it won't define our faith, and that we'll have that thing in Peter that propelled him off the boat to go running to you to be reconciled. Help us not to get caught up in the lie that says that we are defined by our sin. In your name I pray. Amen.